Thank you. We'll go ahead with a roll call, please.
Councilmember Fonzie, here. Councilmember Sturdivant?
Here.
Councilmember Kelly?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Here.
Mayor O'Malley?
Here.
All present.
Thank you. Next item will be the approval of the agenda, and as a reminder, we waive the reading in full of all ordinances appearing on the agenda, and the titles of the ordinances will be read aloud by the city clerk at the first reading after the motion and before the city council votes. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
I have a motion by Councilman Sturdivant, seconded by Councilman Fonzie. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. We have a presentation this evening, employee recognitions, presented by our city manager, Rochelle.
Thank you, Mayor. If I can have my honorees head up, Steve, Tom, Nick, Greg, and Caleb. Come on up. So this is one of my favorite things to do, is recognize our employees. We have an incredible, come this way a little bit further. Yeah.
Here?
Yeah. You can bring your son if you want. No? Okay. This is one of my favorite things. We have an incredible group of employees here at the City of Atascadero and are very lucky to have each and every one of them. And every 5 years, we get to recognize them here at a council meeting and talk about the good stuff that we've done. So I'm going to start with Steve Tirada and have you come join me right here. Steve has proven himself to be a very valuable and integral part of our animal care staff at the Charles Paddock Zoo over the course of the past 5 years. Stephen came to the city and the zoo with a wealth of knowledge, which was gained during his tenure at the horse unit for the LA Police Department and during his years as a keeper at the LA Zoo. This knowledge and past experience has been invaluable to our zoo as we started working with new species and developing areas of our master plan. Steve has a great sense of humor, a little bit wicked sense of humor, and a unique ability to interact with our visiting public. Answering questions or explaining how we manage our animals, often changing their perspectives of zoos and the animals in our care. Steve is also our diker keeper. He's always talking about the diker. He is the proud papa of several baby dikers that we've had at the zoo, including one this spring. A lot of work goes into making that happen and caring for those babies, and we appreciate the work that Steve does. I'm going off script, which is kind of embarrassing. I'm sorry. So thank you, Steve, for your service to the city and the zoo, and we look forward to many more years of service. So thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Let's make you go back in line. Sorry. You thought you were done. You got pictures and shaking hands, all sorts more work. Nick, come on over. So Nick Coughlin is a patrol officer with the Atascadero Police Department and has been with us for 10 years. He has served all of his time in law enforcement with the Atascadero Police Department and has quickly proven himself to be one of the best assets of the department. Nick is a local to Atascadero and has lived in the area his whole life. Nick's investigative skills were evident during his time on patrol, and he was reassigned to the detective unit. During his time in the detective bureau, he was assigned initially as a streets crime detective. He then transferred to the persons crime detective position and remained there for several years. As a persons crime detective, Nick earned the praise of many of his peers, advocates, district attorneys, and victim. Nick's caring and concern was always evident. In fact, if there was anything that might be described as a negative during his time as a person's crime detective, it was that he cared too much. It'd be great if we could all just stay the same. And what a wonderful attribute to have. Nick returned to patrol, but has once again been selected to fill a future opening in the detective bureau. Nick is married to his wife, Tia, and together they have two children, Ezra and Eliana. I believe they're both here. and he enjoys time with his family and spending time at one of the local brew pubs with some of his colleagues. Thank you, Nick. We appreciate your dedication and service to the city of Atascadero. So thank you, Nick. Greg. Sergeant Meyer has been with the police department for 10 years, and we're happy to have him. He came to the Atascadero Police Department after serving several years with both the Los Angeles and the Covina Police Departments. Prior to beginning his service in law enforcement, Greg spent 9 years in the U.S. Army. Sergeant Meyer was hired on as a police sergeant 10 years ago. As such, he is one of our most senior supervisors. Sergeant Meyer is a capable and qualified leader and brings a great deal of diverse experience to the department. During his tenure with the Atascadero, Greg has been instrumental in several key areas of the department, which include implementing the Lexapol policy manual for the department. Lots of fun. That's our policy manual. A lot of detailed work, writing policies, figuring out policies, making sure that's done. Being assigned to the Detective Bureau as a supervisor, and serving the department as a public information officer. He also spent time as an administrative sergeant. He currently works patrol, where he is well respected by his peers. Greg's leadership was recently on display in a high-profile incident, and we could not have been more proud of the way in which he handled himself during that incident. Greg and his wife, Diane, have been married for 24 years. They have two sons, Nick and Matthew. Greg is very committed to his family and enjoys being involved in their lives. Greg has several outside interests, which include attending music concerts with Diane and craft beers. He, too, can often be found sampling some of the offerings at a certain local brew pub. So, Greg, thank you for your service. Sergeant Davis. So Caleb has been with us 10 years. He spent his entire tenure in law enforcement as a police officer with the Atascadero Police Department. And prior to becoming a police officer, Caleb was a school teacher, if you would believe that. We have heard that he likes being an officer much better. Caleb has been a tremendous addition to the Atascadero Police Department. During his time as a motor officer, Caleb was actively involved in grant writing and sought several of the Office of Traffic Safety grants aimed at reducing DUIs on our local roads. As part of these grants, Caleb was able to obtain equipment for a department that we still use today. Caleb was also actively involved in the community as the Atascadero Police Association president. And during his time as president, the association did a great job of being actively involved in community causes and supporting local area youth. I'm sure you guys all know the Police Association puts on a charity golf tournament each year that raises funds for our youth. Caleb and the entire team make that happen. One of Caleb's strengths is project oversight and management. He is currently assigned as the administrative supervisor and has already made an impact on how the department operates professionally. Caleb is married to Julie and has 3 children, Luke, Noah, and Ashlyn. He enjoys camping with his family and has recently become in CrossFit. Caleb also makes his own wine, so not beer, but wine, with partners from the local community. And he's a forward-thinking supervisor and will certainly be a leader of the police department in the years to come. So thank you, Caleb, for your 10 years of service to the city.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good job. Tom. Fire engineer Tom Little has been a full-time with the city for 10 years now, but has been with the city much longer than that. So Tom was originally hired as a reserve firefighter in 2000 and then as a seasonal firefighter in 2002. He became a full-time firefighter in 2006 and was thereafter quickly promoted to fire engineer in 2011. Tom is a member of the fire department's grant writing team. The team has submitted 11 grants in the last 5 years for the fire department and has received over $250,000 in grant funding. Tom has been a member of the North County Technical Rescue Team since 2010. He is also qualified as a line EMT and expanded dispatcher for the U.S. Forest Service. And Tom recently received his California State Fire Officer certification. In 2011, Tom received a commendation for his life-saving efforts while traveling on vacation. We recognized him at a council meeting, if you will remember. Tom and his family stopped at the scene of a medical emergency, and he performed CPR for more than 25 minutes until medical help arrived, which resulted in a life saved due to Tom's efforts. Tom and his wife, Colleen, just celebrated their 20th wedding anniversary. They have 2 children, a son, Matthew, and a daughter, Marissa, and 1 granddaughter, Caitlin. In his off time, Tom enjoys spending time with family and friends. He enjoys reading and is learning to play guitar. So he also came to EMI, where he distinguished himself there at EMI. We were really happy to have him, as he was a large part of it. And so we want to thank you, Tom, for your service. And with that, I'm going to have you guys step forward and have the council come around, and we'll take some pictures. If you can move over to the... And Terry, I have one favor. Can we invite the families up too? They're so much a part of what makes the employees successful. So if they could come up just really quickly for a picture, we'd appreciate it. Come on. Come on up real quick. All right. Come on up. We want everybody. Thank you all.
Well, we're really pleased with our team and proud of our employees, and they do sacrifice a lot and put in a lot extra in our community as well. So thank you all for your service. Next item on our agenda is the consent calendar, which are items considered to be routine in nature, can be passed without a lot of discussion unless any member of the public or the council would like to pull an item for more discussion. Are there any consent calendar items the council would like to pull for discussion? Now, how about members of the public? Any consent calendar item? Seeing none, then I would entertain a motion to approve the consent calendar.
So move approval. I'll second.
OK, Okay, we have a motion by Councilman Sturdivant, seconded by Mayor Pro Tem Moreno to approve the consent calendar. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thanks. Next item on the agenda is updates from the city manager.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. The first item I want to talk about is the F-14 road maintenance projects. So these road maintenance projects were the first of two projects that we let this summer, this fall, and these projects are nearing completion. So they're finishing up. There's just a few punch item lists to do it. I know the residents on these streets are very happy to have their roads paved, and they look fantastic. The road maintenance project included a couple of different areas on Arena, a portion of Yerba, San Vicente, and Castano. So if you get a chance, go out and take a look at the work that our contractor did. It's nice to see some of these smaller neighborhood roads getting paved. And the next one is the larger of the two projects, and this is the road rehabilitation project. As you remember, we let the contract out about a month ago, and those projects are now taking place. The projects include San Andreas, San Clemente, Cascabel, Los Gatos, and Valle Avenues, and affected roads will be closed to through traffic during these projects. Access is to all the residents and the project will be maintained. We have done extensive outreach and we continue to do outreach to those residents that live in the project areas. The project started this week and it's expected to take up to 5 months. These are roads that take a little bit more work, a little bit heavier work than those road maintenance projects, but we're excited to have them happen. You just also approved our the engineering to start designing our 16-17 road projects. And we hope to have those out next spring. So F-14, now that we're starting to get some money, we're starting to get those roads paved and get out there, and we're excited. This Saturday is Fall Community Cleanup Day. It is at the City Corporate Yard at 8005 Garbata from 8 to 2 p.m. This is a chance to come drop off all of your waste at the corporate yard, and we will take care of it and make sure it gets into the landfill. It's sponsored by Waste Management. They will not be accepting hazardous waste. There are methods to get rid of some of the hazardous waste, and you can find that information on Waste Management website. But they will be accepting green waste, bulky items, scrap metal, and non-freon appliances. And so that is this Saturday. Come drop it off at the corporate yard. There's a few rules on, they'd like to have your trash bagged and some of those, but it's a great opportunity to get some of that stuff that's cluttering up your yard or garage or just want to get rid of it. And I want to talk about the Showdown Corn Toss Tournament. We had 32 teams at the tournament this last Saturday. We are hoping that it will be an annual corn toss tournament. It was very well accepted. Laura participated in the corn toss tournament. She can actually toss the corn bags while holding her dog in one arm. It's quite a sight to see. I also participated. I wasn't quite as ambidextrous as Laura, but I had a great time. That seemed to be the theme of the day. Everybody I talked to had an amazing time. It was a beautiful day. We had a costume contest. Commander Allen and his son AJ won the costume contest with their Duck Dynasty costumes, but we had some cowboys and Indians and other costumes, and it was wonderful. This was a fantastic event. I've been hit up now three separate times in grocery stores and others saying, okay, you're going to do that again, aren't you? Everybody would love to see it happen every weekend. I think we're going to go for once a year. It's a lot of work. A lot of that work was put in by the Knights of Columbus and the Kiwanis. Both of those groups did an amazing job. The tournament was well organized. Qantas and Knights made 128 boards, over 500 corn bags, got all of them set up and out there. They did a great job, so I want to make sure we give a large shout out to them. So it was a good event, and we'd like to see more. I would estimate that overall there were between 200 to 300 people there in the sunken gardens toward the ends of the day, enjoying the food trucks. We had a couple of beer vendors and just enjoying the sunshine and watching the tournament. So good event, great place to build on. We had our PPOD drill, don't ask me what that stands for because I'm not quite sure, and Flu Vaccination Day. It is a drill put on by County Health in conjunction with the fire department to simulate a medical emergency, and as part of doing that, we give out flu shots. We successfully distributed 445 shots to men, women, and children throughout the day. The last month, the South County drill also distributed 435 shots, so together was 880 shots that were distributed. I did, again, participate in this activity, too, and I have to say it was extremely well organized. I get my flu shot every year. I could have been in and out if I hadn't stopped to chat with everybody in less than 5 minutes. It was painless. It was a great opportunity and went off very well. So another good event. And speaking of good events, we have Zubu. So after you drop off your trash at the corporate yard that evening, come on out to Zubu. It's going to be Saturday, October 29th from 5 to 8:30 p.m. at the Charles Paddock Zoo. They have games, haunted house, music, and generally just a good time. It is great to see the kids and adults smiling from ear to ear, getting excited, playing those games. This annual event is sponsored by Pure Pediatric Dentistry, the Tribune, New Times, and 93.3 KZOZ, and we appreciate their support because without them, we couldn't have these type of events. It's a $10 admission and $9 if you are a Friends of the Zoo member, and it is free to children 2 and under. We also have Veterans Day ceremony and barbecue coming up. That will be on Friday, November 11th, and the ceremony will be at the Faces of Freedom Veterans Memorial at 11 a.m. on Friday, November 11th. This is another fantastic event and ceremony put on by the Veterans Association. There is a community barbecue following the ceremony. It's $8 for tri-tip sandwiches, salad, drinks, chips, salad, chips, and a drink. Or you can go $5 for a hot dog meal or half a sandwich, and you still get the salad, chips, and drink. So it's a great deal as well as supporting a very worthy cause. I'm drawing a blank on the Faces of Freedom group puts a lot of work into that area, works with the city on that, and these funds tend to go towards that. And while we're talking about maintaining statues, I want to talk about the Tiger Statue Restoration. It's time for our gorgeous statues, tiger statue that graces the front entrance of the Charles Paddock Zoo to get a makeover. Staff met with Susan Beatty, and she's the original artist of the statue, and representatives from Genesis Bronze a few weeks ago to talk about moving the tiger out of the flamingo exhibit to the Genesis Bronze Foundry for a much-needed cleaning. The tiger is 25 years old. I can't believe it's been there that long. And it's quite a process to clean it. We'll have to build a temporary fence right through the middle of that pond that you see there. So we'll drain the pond, build a fence there, move the flamingos to the other side of the fence and out of the danger zone. Flamingos are a lot like a lot of other birds. They're very nervous and flighty. So you want to be very careful when we're moving them and changing their exhibit. We also need to avoid the breeding season because we're one of the few zoos that is successfully breeding flamingos right now, and so we want to make sure that we don't mess with that. The statue will be craned out onto a truck and taken to the foundry, and at the foundry they will sandblast the entire statue, taking it down to its original metals, and then applying a new protective coating. The artist will then repaint the black tiger stripes that you see prior to returning the statue home for reinstallation. Without this much-needed cleaning and reapplication of the protective coating, bird droppings and weather will continue to corrode the bronze statue. I was talking to Susan on, well, what happens if this doesn't happen? In addition to the green color that you're starting to see, basically, all that weather just starts eating away at the bronze, so you just need to keep every 25 years or so reapplying the protective coating. Donations are needed to fund this much-needed work, and Susan, along with the friends, have raised about half to do the needed $10,000 restoration. Every little bit helps, so if you're interested in donating the statue project, please send a check to the Friends of the Charles Paddock Zoo at 9305 Pismo Avenue and mark it Tiger Statue. Or if you know Susan Beatty, I'm sure she'd be happy to make sure that your donation gets to the right spot. So, a worthy project. We need a few more donations to make it happen. We're hoping to have it happen this December or January. The foundry's agreed to begin work with the deposit that we put down on the project, but we need to raise the rest. So, please help us with that. And at our last meeting, Councilmember Fondi asked staff to give a brief report on our marketing efforts and success in attracting business and industry to Atascadero. The council's economic strategy is to attract and retain quality businesses here in Atascadero. But obviously, marketing to businesses is a little bit different than, say, marketing an event or something that you run a radio ad on. So a lot of the marketing to businesses is a little bit more subtle. It's taking place all day, every day, and I just want to share some of those efforts on that. The main thing that we've been doing is getting the word out that Atascadero wants business here. We want you, your business. We want you to be here. If you're willing to invest in Atascadero, we're willing to invest in you. And we want to make sure we're getting our story out. One of the ways we do that is to work with our business industry partners to get that story out. So that may involve and has involved presentation at the EVC on what it is we're doing, what incentives council has authorized, what we've done successfully for other projects, and the types of businesses that we've been able to attract. That, a lot of times, generates into meeting with different EVC, Economic Vitality Corporation, board members, or introductions by the EVC president to other industry leaders. And so we tend to meet with those business industry leaders, trying to find out what is it that you think you need to move here or to attract businesses. We've also had mayor presentations at the North County Chamber, State of the North County. We had the city manager did a presentation at the State of the North County. We do presentations to various groups such as realtors, home builders, commercial brokers, all of those types of things. We're very active participants in the EVC. Both Bob and Heather have been members, and I think both of them were very large advocates for Atascadero, trying to attract people up here, and have been very successful in getting meetings with industry leaders. And like I said, we're meeting with those industry representatives, broadband, light manufacturing, office, anything where, hey, we're talking with one person, but they tend to be representing the whole group, and they want to come up here and find out what we have to offer. Another part of ours is we want to treat every customer that walks through that door as if they are the most important thing in getting their business and what they want up. is our most important job. Businesses that have a good experience are our best marketing tool. They tend to pass it on or be talking with another person in the same industry or a different industry. That gets that word out, and we're starting to hear that a lot. We want to make sure that every business has a good experience. We want to be on the business's side on how do we work within the regulations that the state and the Fed and everybody has given us, but still get you exactly what you want, and how do we make that as easy as possible so that when you're done with your project, you can go tell the next person, hey, that wasn't that bad. You know, they're going to help you through it. And that's what we're hearing. So it's working. And we're a facilitator. I had somebody reach out to me today saying, hey, I'm looking for 7,000 to 10,000 square feet to locate my business here in Atascadero. We're bursting at the seams. I need to hire more employees. Where can I go? We're talking with business owners, developers, others that are looking for tenants or looking to build to suit tenants. Let's see if we can put those people together, have them talking, trying to get there. So we try to connect, facilitate, and do a lot of that. And then in addition to that, we do have some more traditional promotions. We want to actively promote positive things going on here in Atascadero. You can't necessarily draw a straight line from us having a corn toss tournament to that business calling today. But the more positive buzz that people are talking about Atascadero, the more it's tickled in their head. Hey, don't forget about Atascadero. I think that has had a lot more positive effect than I thought it would on doing that. So it's creating a positive buzz here in Atascadero. I'm going to tell you right now, there is more business investment happening here in Atascadero right now than in my last 20 years here with the city. I've been here for 20 years. There's a high demand for large spaces here in Atascadero. And why not? Our rent is more reasonable than our neighbors. The workforce already lives here. It's the best place to live in the county. We're affordable, good schools, great community. And so they want to locate their businesses here, and we want them. So we're an attractive place to house business. There has been considerable interest in light manufacturing, engineering, technology, microbrews, and other industries. And as we learned in the El Camino vacancy study, Atascadero's biggest constraint is not how many businesses are interested in being here, but instead is the lack of large available space. The vacancies that we have tend to be smaller spaces or owner constrained, and the businesses interested in locating here are looking for that 7,000 plus square feet. So we have some inventory. A lot of those vacancies you see are 2,000, 1,300 square feet, maybe 3,000 square feet at the offset. The interest is much bigger than that. Our small lots make it hard for somebody to develop those large spaces. They have to assemble a number of different lots in order to do that and join them in order to construct that. And assembling or buying those different lots from different owners takes time and is something they don't want advertised. They don't want to be telling people, hey, I want to buy these three lots that are next to each other, because that drives their price. So I'm going to tell you that we believe a lot of that investment is happening. It is quiet investment, but it is occurring. There are people out there assembling parcels for commercial development to house those businesses that are interested in being here. And those are the businesses they want with good paying jobs. There are some successes that we can talk about because the deals have been closed. Colony Square has been purchased. Plans are underway. Both owners of the Colony Square development are coming into community development and submitting plans to get that project, the rest of that project, built out. We know that there's been significant commercial investment up by the Del Rio not just Walmart, but the annex and other parcels around there. We had several interested parties coming in doing due diligence on the Gary Bang building. They all wanted to purchase that building. Santa Maria Brewing was the final successful purchaser of that building. And they have plans in for a restaurant, brew pub, along with a larger brewing facility there. Great use, good jobs here in Atascadero. The old Citibank building was purchased and has new tenants. They're doing a lot of significant tenant improvements there. That is up and running. We see new construction and buildings along Morrow Road. Buildings where they may appear vacant, but that's because somebody is renting that or going to rent it that starts out small, but they're saying don't rent the rest because we're going to take it all here within a short period of time. All of those things are happening, and that's just what's visible. But I want to assure you that there's a lot more going on that's quiet, that we are either not privy to any details, or if we are aware of some details, we're asked not to share. So that is just a little bit of brief highlight of what we're doing on attracting business here in Atascadero. And speaking of attracting new businesses, I want to give a shout out to Crickets. They are a new restaurant here in town. They opened about 2 weeks ago, so they're still in their soft opening phase. They're at 9700 El Camino Real near the post office. They have sandwiches, breakfast, baked goods, quiche, soup, salad, and of course all sorts of coffee, lattes, espresso, mochas, you name it. They're open Monday through Saturday, 6 a.m. to 3 p.m. And I have to say, I went there for lunch today, and it was really, really good. So we're having hopefully another successful business partner move here to Atascadero, and want to encourage everybody to go give them a try. Really good lunch to go with some of our other latest additions to the restaurant scene, such as Marston, Streetside, Cochi, among others. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any council questions? Seeing none, thank you for that update. We'll now move to community forum, which is an opportunity for any of you to speak to all of us on any topic that is not on the agenda. And I'll just point out there's really only two significant items coming up later. One, the management report C1 has to do with some requirements coming from the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and that will be primarily doing some research on what we need to do to prepare for that. And then item two, a little update on Proposition 64, and I do want to make it clear we're not taking any action tonight. It is an update requested by the council with some questions raised. As you know, we directed staff to prepare after the ballot initiative is resolved after the election. We'll kind of know what to expect, and staff is prepared to move forward from there. But this will be just a little bit of an update with no action taken tonight. So with that, I'll open up to community forum and welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Gary Kirkland. I'm here representing the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, which I'm a member, and also the Central Coast Taxpayers Association, which I'm also a member. And what I want to discuss is what's going on with the county in regards to Measure J. I was at a Board of Supervisors meeting when Rita Neal, the county council, announced that after an initiative is on the ballot, government employees, county government employees, city government employees, or contractors may not advocate for any initiative that's on the ballot. And what we've seen, and Andreas Easterend, also a member of the Central Coast Taxpayers Association, has filed a complaint with the PCCA.
FPPC.
FPPC, about what the county has been doing and county employees have been doing. They have been sending out flyers. I got one of them. And these flyers are not just information. They're advocacy. They have glossy pictures of all the things that are going to happen if Measure J passes. Very little or none about what the downside, including it's a regressive tax that hurts poor people much more than rich people. And it also rewards the state by keeping our money, which the county is giving into blackmail. It also doesn't mention that several cities, including Atascadero, have already passed tax increases, sales tax increases like Measure J. And so this is going to be another increase that the citizens of this city are going to have to absorb if it's passed. That's not mentioned. And also, we have the situation where people in this state are overtaxed. Now, the reason I mention the blackmail, I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, these our citizens have already paid money to the state for our roads, and which is what Measure J is supposed to be about. The money went to the state, and the state decided to keep it. And what they told us, many counties, including this one, if you pass a self-help, quote, self-help tax, which is what Measure J is, they call it an investment, it's a tax, then what? Not only will you have the money to fix the state roads in the county, but you can use that money to leverage for grants, which were mentioned here. We have grant writers working for the city. And we won't be self-help anymore because we'll be using that money to leverage money from the state and from the national government in order to get more money for the roads. As far as the federal government goes, as I understand it, our federal government is now $19 trillion in debt. And yet we have many governments, including this one and the county government and all over the country, writing grants, trying to get more money out of the national government. And I'm reading The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire right now by Gibbons. Oh, sorry. Anyway, I'm urging we vote no for this thing and do not pass Measure J. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, next speaker.
Good evening. It's 2-0 Cleveland in the bottom of the fourth.
And if you just state your name for the record, and thank you for that update, we'll start the clock over.
Okay, thank you. My name is Mitch Paskin. I'm a resident of Atascadero, and I'm back. So I read in the in an August 11th Tribune article where Mayor O'Malley was quoted talking about the Walmart project, and the quote said, "Well, we want any new development to pay its fair share its way so that new development doesn't shift costs onto existing residents." So I'm here to get an update on what's going on with Oak Ridge Estates and what's happening with Los Altos and San Marcos Road. In the past, the mayor has said that there'll be money and fees coming into the city to pay for the damage on the road. Right now, according to the conditions of development, the people of Atascadero are responsible for 75% of the damage done to Los Altos and San Marcos Road. Okay, coming out of our pockets. So I would like an update on what's happening with that. And if the fees, I did a California Public Records Act request, looked at the fees when that have been paid for three of the houses that have been recently constructed. There's no extraordinary fees there. I went over it with the staff member, just normal fees. So I don't know where the money is coming from to fix the roads. Another thing I would like is an update on, a minute and a half, perfect. another thing I would like is an update on the intersection at SR 41 and Los Altos Road. It's 10 years. Since, you know, the original conditions of approval said that should have been done in 2006. It's 2016. Intersection hasn't been touched. And after 8 years of being delinquent, the city council, in your wisdom, gave him an additional 3 years, blaming Caltrans, which I had documents saying that wasn't the truth. Okay? So I talked to Caltrans around 6 weeks ago, and nothing had been done. No permits had been pulled. And it's supposed to be completed by April. You have absolutely no leverage to make him perform, to make Castle Rock and Darren Shetler perform on this, the way that you structured the deal. So I would like an update on all of this. And I'd like the mayor to tell us where that money's coming from to fix the roads. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other speakers? Welcome. Those that haven't been to public comment before, we always take all public comment, we'll then close it, and we'll have staff respond to as many questions as they can. Welcome.
Good evening, Jim Wilkins with the Tascadero Historical Society. And I'd like to bring the mayor, council, and the staff and the community up to date on our Colony Heritage Project. We've been working with city to get the two more houses from the annex, which is Madonna Enterprise, and the Walmart project, to get those two houses moved down here. Some of you knew last, was it July, there was a little grass fire out there and kind of scorched the tail feathers of our archival building, but didn't do too much structural damage, so we were fortunate there. We need to do some fundraising now because one of the requirements through us and the city is that we put the cabin on a foundation that's sitting up there a little over a year now, so we're going to start a fundraiser on November 12th out at Pear Valley, and we have some flyers. I want to make sure we get a flyer to Planning Department, Public Works, and the Building Department because they've been great to work with. They've been working with us, and it's really been awesome. We're trying not to rush this one like we did 5 weeks last year. We're trying to take 5 or 6 months. So, but it's got dinner. We're putting on a dinner. Pear Valley's offered their facility. So you'll get a dinner, Pear Valley wine. We're going to have a silent auction, and then kind of an overview of the project itself. So we'd like to see everybody out there. You can pick up tickets over at Chamber. You can get a hold of me direct at Atascadero Colony Museum at Gmail, and I'll respond back to you and make sure we get some tickets to you. So thanks.
Thank you. Any other speakers? Seeing no one come forward. Oh, please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, Council. My name is Deborah Eckhart. I am the grateful owner of a 100-year-old home that my parents bought in 1949. Both were very hardworking, civil, and very nice people. They brought us up well, and I love my home. For 8 years, I've been living next to a family fully invested in the cannabis culture. A family who has for years been buying, smoking, eating, growing, and selling marijuana. The behavioral problems affecting several generations of this family are immense. The amount of chaos and disturbing behavior is very troubling to me, and it should be to you, in my opinion. Lots of foul language, arguing, partying, chaos, and doing, it appears, very little else. The few people living there have jobs, yet most drive new cars. You see cars and people walking in out of the property day and night. People driving impaired. I've seen, actually, several of the residents and visitors smoke a pipe or a joint and drive away onto our streets within minutes. I see this almost every day, up close and personal. If we allow recreational marijuana in this community, I fear that we are being quite narrow in our thinking. It's not just about providing critically ill patients with a life-enhancing drug or being a spiritual experience or being a stress reliever or tax revenues. If we are looking at it only in those terms, we are losing sight of a much bigger picture, in my opinion. Medical marijuana is being abused today by people living in this town who have the card, but not a legitimate reason, medical reason, to use the card and receive medical marijuana. How are we going to enforce it? While California is about perhaps to pass Proposition 64, our police and sheriff officers still have no state-approved method for testing cannabis. Is that it?
If you want to finish your thought and...
Okay. I cannot sit here and do nothing, say nothing. I must act. I'm not a public person. I don't want to come here. But I'm forced to do this by my own desire to change or to impact the community and how we vote. I urge you to use all your resources available to become street smart before making a judgment either for or against Proposition 64. Those who follow me, I have no grandchildren, no children, to leave a legacy to, that voting for Proposition 64 or not, you know, will impact.
Thank you.
But I still care about yours.
Thank you. And I hope you're able to stay a little bit for the update the city attorney will be doing later under another item. And I'll ask staff just to include those that message with the other item. I didn't want to cut you off because we actually have another item on the agenda that would fit a little bit better with. We'll make sure that your input is attached to that for future reference. So thank you. Any other member of the public wishing to speak on any item not on the agenda? Seeing no one approach, we'll close public comment, bring it back to staff. And I know Mr. Paskins has approached the council before. I think we've addressed a number of these questions. And there's a range of items that occur over time. There's several different project questions to be addressed. Ms. City Manager, would you have the city engineer address that, or is that finance? Or
I would actually, if you would indulge me, Mayor, like to bring back a just similar to what we just did for Councilmember Fonzie's request last week. Do it under City Manager's report next council meeting. That way I can get the conditions of approval, have all that information at staff's fingertips so that we can get you an accurate and up-to-date report. We will also be able to, I can address the update on Highway 41 at that time too, if that would work.
Good. Yeah, there were a number of questions in the one comment. So if you would just go to the record, review the questions that were asked, and that's realistic that in 2 weeks you could come back and address those questions.
I believe so. If not, I will
take your
tell
best
you
shot,
in 2 weeks.
And yes. If we need more, we can have you do more. Okay, thank you. Yes, and we need to have any comments. We had a comment from the public, which public comment is closed now, but a member of the public asked if we were going to be meeting on Election Day, and yes, we work all the time. Thank you. With that, we're going to move on from Community Forum and on to our first manager report, item C1, development of the City of Tascadero's Local Area Management Program, LAMP. And as I recall, we had to address this issue with the Regional Water Quality Control Board some years ago. I know I had to testify before the Water Board. John Neal from our water company, our previous city engineer, did a very good job of basically explaining to the Regional Water Board that we did not need to have all 5,400 septic systems in our city inspected annually at a cost of $100 each and pumped annually at another $400 each. That would have been a cost of, you can imagine, $500 a year times 5,400 would have been a significant cost to our community. We all worked hard as a city to let the Water Board know that we could come up with a plan, and we've managed it well because there has not been a septic system failure that hasn't been resolved in a very short amount of time by city staff working with the private property owners. So this is kind of coming back now because we have to up our response on this. It's a very important thing that we, again, as the city manager explained, our staff has to work pretty hard to be that buffer between lots of state regulations and our community. And I think our staff do a good job on that interface. So with that, we are going to be looking at a plan to do our plan, I understand. And I believe Mr. Nick DeBar, our Public Works Director, will get us up to speed on this.
Thank you, Mayor O'Malley. Luke's loading this up. Had it saved in the wrong location. Sorry, Luke. It's a little background on this. The Water Resources Control Board adopted this document that we'll refer to as OWTS policy, but it's entitled Water Quality Control Policy for Siting, Design, Operation, and Maintenance of On-Site Wastewater Treatment Systems. It actually establishes a statewide risk-based tiered approach for on-site septic systems and on-site wastewater treatment systems. That also includes not only the installations but the replacement of these systems, and sets a level for the performance and protection that's expected of the groundwater from these systems. So it's not really trying to like do away with these or anything, but they wanted to set a statewide standard for what these systems should be. And really, who's impacted by this? If you're like me, I know a lot of you are, you have an on-site wastewater septic system, so you're impacted. Also, cities and other regulatory agencies, counties and other and local agencies, the regional water board and state water board. There's over 1.2 million on-site wastewater treatment systems in the state. And in Atascadero, this actually policy affects over 3,000 developed and undeveloped parcels. So if unless you're on a city sewer or, you know, if you're a developed property, chances are you have a septic system or one of these OWTSs on your site. So these this tiered approach I talked about, this policy has four. And tier zero is really any existing OWTS that is in good condition, good working order. You know, as through the life and over time, say my septic system, say maybe in 5 years it starts failing, it might go to a different tier, and then if I fix it, it'll go back to another tier. So that's kind of how this is meant to work. Tier one is really low risk, new or replacement systems. So this would be if you got good draining soils, it's all sand or whatever, but if you have a conservative design and it's working, it would fall underneath these requirements that are in the policy. Tier two is what we call this LAMP, Local Area Management Program. These all really address newer replacement OWTSs. And I'll get to the LAMP here in a minute. Tier three would really be for any systems that are close to, you know, under the jurisdiction of a total maximum daily load or some other impaired waterway that the state has identified, or, you know, with subject to, you know, having a waste load allocation of only a certain amount of pollutants that can be soaked back into the ground. And then tier four is any one of these systems that requires a corrective action to it. I know it's kind of confusing when I first read this too. I thought, okay, what is, and then as I thought about it, as you know, through the life of these systems, it can go into any one of these tiers actually, except tier three, unless you're in one of those protected areas. So the policy also defines responsibilities and duties for those affected parties, includes standards for siting, design, construction, operation, and maintenance for each of one of these tiers. So each chapter in there is like tier zero, tier one, and goes through a lot of these requirements. Really, this we've got issues with this from a Atascadero standpoint. It really doesn't fit our character. Some of the issues, it's like a one-size-fits-all. It's really the site-specific conditions are not fully considered when they determine the feasibility of siting these OWTSs. Rather, than that, you know, a boilerplate approach is given, you know, based upon average annual rainfall. You know, for instance, for how big of a lot size can you place one of these on? So if you look at Atascadero's average rainfall and go through that calculation, it comes back and says, okay, without a pretreatment system, you can build one of these if you have the right underlying soil conditions on a lot size of 2 acres or more. Well, we've got a lot of on-site wastewater treatment systems on much, much smaller than that, you know, on acre, you know, half an acre and less. You know, right now I think it's a 1 acre minimum that we try to achieve. So this really doubles that amount. For second units, it would double that as well. So now you're looking at 4 acres to have a second unit on a site. These pretreatment, you could still do it, but these pretreatment systems would be required, and these are estimated to be $40,000 or more dollars. So it's really kind of ridiculous if you think about, we don't have a pollution problem with our groundwater. We've been great stewards of the groundwater, partnering with the water company, and so you can see why this policy is really kind of a bad policy for us. As I mentioned, some of those underlying soil conditions, like a depth to fractured bedrock, we've got a lot of properties that have OWTSs that work just fine with fractured bedrock. Well, this new policy, that's one of the things I would say is, like, you know, if you don't have certain depth to that fractured bedrock, they're not going to allow you to do that, but you got to put in one of these pretreatment systems. It's also written to address cross-contamination between on-site septic systems and on-site private wells, you know, much like a county would have. Tascadero Mutual Water Company encompasses the entire city limits. So, say, if, you know, any development that's going on, they'll serve that property. They've got everything covered. So very, very, very few private wells on parcels. And really, it's just a very conservative design requirements that it contains that just really aren't applicable to our unique characteristic. So some of the options that we have to consider is we can do nothing and just fall underneath that OWTS policy. The second one is we can fall underneath and have an agreement with another permitting agency to fall underneath their local area management plan. So, for instance, Slo County is working on one. We've actually been attending a lot of their workshops, and initially we're thinking, hey, you know, we might be able to piggyback on this. We don't have a ton of these that we look at every year. Maybe this will work out where, you know, maybe we can kind of steal some of their ideas from theirs and their draft and develop our own, or maybe even partner with them to have them review some of these. Well, upon further inspection of their draft, they really don't kind of meet our requirements either. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, a lot of those properties in the county have those private wells situated on them. And then the third option is really to develop our own Atascadero LAMP. You know, it would address the unique nature of Atascadero, which is small urban, large, you know, rural character. It also addresses the fact that we have a water company, a public supplier, that encompasses the entire city. And then it provides flexibility and some options. So some of these LAMP components that, if this item were to move ahead, we expect a city-specific LAMP to address existing groundwater and hydrogeological conditions. Also establish those siting and design requirements for various areas based upon the allowable wastewater loading that the underlying soils can handle. And then part of that, with that, would be identify areas throughout town. Maybe it's half a dozen to a dozen areas that have similar characteristics where we can have siting requirements and siting standards for that. also identify areas that we may have to have pretreatment systems required, or areas that we could maybe extend the municipal sanitary sewer system to. So, I mean, we can think of a couple areas that have already been looked at in the past that we could easily extend the sanitary sewer to that might not meet these OWTS policy requirements, or maybe even some of the LAMP requirements that we come up with. But the ultimate goal is to really demonstrate that all these existing and future OWTSs will protect the groundwater. A little schedule on it. We're looking at, you know, this was an unbudgeted item. This has been around for a couple years, but we've been kind of looking at the county and seeing if we could maybe go that route. It would save a lot of duplication with our efforts, but it's looking like, you know, we're recommending to go our own way with our own city-specific Atascadero LAMP. But, you know, if we were to move ahead with this, we could get a consultant on board and really have a draft LAMP to look at sometime early next year. Really, the key deadline is May 2018. That's the deadline for us to have an approved LAMP. All this will be required to be approved by the water board, the local water board, and we feel really comfortable that we can demonstrate to them that what we've been doing, and ultimately that's what we want to get out of this, is really not change things that much and be able to do what we've been doing as much as possible, doing what we know that works, and really getting that May 2018 deadline so we can avoid having to fall underneath that the statewide OWTS policy. So the recommendation tonight is to really direct staff to pursue the development of a city Atascadero LAMP and to contract services with a qualified professional consultant to assist with this effort. And then second is the budget piece is to authorize the administrative services director to amend the current budget by appropriating what we think would be about up to $50,000 from the general fund reserves to cover the cost in developing a city LAMP. And we don't know an exact consultant professional fee yet, but we've talked to a number of qualified engineering professionals, and we're comfortable it would be under $50,000. So with that, I can answer any questions you have, and if I can't answer it, Public Works Deputy Director Ryan Hayes is in the audience, so he's been primarily working on this, so he has a lot more knowledge and specifics on the OWTS policy than I do.
Thank you. And I see council are using the lights that I have so I can know who's next up to speak or ask a question. We'll go to council questions and we'll open it up to the public. Thank you for that good overview. First, we have Councilwoman Fonzie, followed by Councilman Sturdivant.
Thank you. I see the city engineers occupied. I'll wait a minute. Just a question. Why do you think this is coming up now? Is there a move afoot with the state to license septic tank owners? Is there a problem that's triggered this? What's going on?
Well, I think it's been in works for a while. I think it all stems back to the Clean Water Act. And, you know, as that whole thing has evolved since it got adopted in the, I guess it was 72 or whenever it was, you know, they've gone after the point source polluters, like with wastewater, industrial, and then eventually it falls into stormwater and the MS4s and everybody else. But now they're really kind of gearing in on this, and I think it all has to do with, you know, that whole groundwater sustainability and kind of the groundwater issues that the state has had, and just making sure that, you know, the groundwater supplies we do have remain protected, and there's some standardized way of doing it. I kind of look at it as an unfunded mandate, but I mean that's just my personal opinion.
Well, $50,000 is a lot to for the state to foist onto local entities like cities.
It is, and one of the speaking of that $50,000, I mean that could, if that could deter one property from having to build a pretreatment system, I mean that might pay for itself right there. And I'm not trying to advocate for that, $50,000. I'm just bringing forth what we found it would cost to get this done.
Right, but the issue is we haven't had a problem, so they're proposing a solution to something that isn't a problem.
We've had that discussion already.
Yes, we have.
With them.
Could you explain to us what a pre-treatment system would be, how it would be different than a regular septic tank?
So, Ryan, you want to tackle that one? I can give you some examples. There's some like a mechanical system, so maybe you need to knock down phosphorus or some kind of component in there that the underlying soils might not be able to take out or just get it to a treated effluent level before you can put it back into the ground. But maybe Ryan has some additional ideas.
Yeah, Nick's correct. It's It's essentially just a separate secondary septic system. So you'd use your existing septic system, but you'd have to, the influent into your septic system would have to be at a level where what was going into the ground had already been pre-treated. So that would be, it'd be cost prohibitive, and then it would also need to be maintained. And part of the OWTS policy is much like our stormwater on-site post-construction requirements, we would be responsible as a city to monitor and do the operations and maintenance for every single one of these pretreatment systems that got put in. So it puts the onus back on us as well. So.
And so this study will identify the areas based on soil structure or other criteria that may require pretreatment?
That's correct. We're thinking that at this point there's probably three or four areas in town that have been identified from when it was the county that are poor site areas. There's, I think, four that are identified that don't have sewer yet. And those areas, just because of lot sizes, small lot sizes, and the geological systems may still require some sort of on-site if we don't, you know, at some point bring them on to our sewer system.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Councilman Sturdivant.
Yes, the if we have to, my understanding is with this LAMP, we have to prove that it works. We have to prove that we were keeping our groundwater safe. And so there's got to be levels that were being measured at or certain criteria. So I'm curious, is there going to be a time frame on this LAMP, or is it possible to have specific levels today and then a year from now, 2 years from now, those levels change and we may not be in compliance or that type of a scenario?
I think anything's possible with the state. They like to change the ground rules sometimes and tweak things if they feel like it's not working or, you know, they missed something in the long term. But there's been a number of LAMPs that have been approved by them that we've reviewed. You know, Atascadero is a lot like a county in many respects, with exception to that potable water supply. They have approved some, and I know Ryan and has talked with the board a little bit about our situation and how we can kind of make this more, you know, unique to us and not the one size fits all and just, you know, comply with the state OWTS.
Is there any indication at this point in time about a time frame for our LAMP? In other words, good for 3 years, 2 years, 5 years?
Well, I think it's probably good for the foreseeable future. So if we were to get a draft LAMP and maybe, Ryan, is there any expiration date? I don't believe there is.
There's no expiration that I know of, except that if the state were to come out with another OWTS policy, then that would probably impact.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Councilwoman Moreno, followed by Councilman Kelly.
Director, you mentioned that because we do have some similar circumstances, the county, except for the potable water. Is there any way that we can piggyback on some of that? Can we get some benefit of that so that maybe we're not having to cover 100% of the cost of our LAMP, but use some of theirs and add to it? Is that possible, or do we really just need to completely do our own?
I think you could take components of it, but you know, a lot of this would be looking at our unique, you know, soil conditions, our unique groundwater conditions. I know Ryan has reviewed that, so he might be able to comment further on that.
I think to some extent we will piggyback just because there have not been many cities that have done these. This is an unusual situation, but almost, actually I think every county in the state has, and they're just coming back with the first, they all submitted their drafts in May, and they're just coming back with their regional boards with comments right now. So to some extent we are going to piggyback on all of the other counties because we're going to see what is and isn't approved. Having said that, we only deal with our regional water board. And as far as I know, just, well, it would be Santa Barbara, Monterey County, and San Luis County are the only ones that have submitted anything through them. Santa Barbara's has already been approved. So we'll piggyback as much as we can on the comments that we've gotten. Okay. Answer to that.
And each water board, you know, like we're in the Central Coast, they have some autonomy with how they perceive things, how they interpret the state water board's policies.
Yeah, I was just thinking to the extent that we can, you know, save any money in this process. We always look at that anyway. So, also, if this were not approved, can you go back and tell me how, which properties would be required to have a pretreatment system?
Yeah, that would be all whenever somebody would come in to develop that site.
Or replace a failing system.
Or fix a failing sewer. You know, they'd have to do all that testing like they do now. They do percolation testing. They do some evaluations. We require that right now to approve these. But we wouldn't know until they came in. So one of the things we want to do is give some certainty to these properties in town, demonstrate that they are buildable. They can, in fact, you know, from kind of the gross way we'll look at things and kind of the kind of comprehensively, not, you know, really getting down and doing testing, but being able to demonstrate that those can, in fact, support these on-site systems without pretreatment.
So what you're saying is that if somebody was putting in a new system, if they had a certain, like the bedrock, right, the closeness or proximity of the system to the bedrock, that would just automatically trigger a pre-system unless we can say through our LAMP that, hey, no, we have those and they work just fine and that's not a problem here in Atascadero.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Councilman Kelly.
Yes. Currently, I think when somebody puts an application in for a septic system, we have three percolation holes and one soils testing. This usually goes down about 15 feet or so. Can you anticipate a much more thorough geological testing platform that would have to be performed at a very high cost in order to put a application in for a septic system permit?
Well, that's what we're kind of hoping to get out of this LAMP, is that they don't have to expend a lot more money than that, because we know that works right now. I mean, it's been working great. I mean, it's been working for a long time, but, you know, they might, the board, if we do a draft LAMP, they might say, no, we don't like that. You guys got to do four pits now, and you got to do two soil tests, and they got to go down to 25 feet or to groundwater. But it's still much more cheaper than a pre-treatment system if you can avoid that.
So did I understand you to say that the newer systems would have one or two sets of leach lines, one that would be active, and if you ran into a problem, there's a switch in a tank there where you can switch over to the other leach line? And if that's the case, what would the expansion area have to be for future failures? And how would that be handled in some of our lots that are on the side of hills with trees?
I can comment a little bit on that. You wouldn't have to have two systems. It would be, so currently, right now, we require that you leave the space for 100% upsize of your leach system. The state OWTS, so Nick had mentioned earlier, and he's correct, we have about 3,000 properties that are less than 2 acres, and those would have immediate, if your system were either to fail or it was an undeveloped parcel, those would have the immediate effect of under the state system, or the policy requiring this pretreatment system. But it'll affect everybody, because the state, if we were to go with the state system, it also affects the sizing of all of the leach fields, and it's about 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 bigger than what we do right now, which is a pretty conservative leach field. And the 100% build out that we have to set aside right now. You have to build that out when you do your original system. So it would affect everybody significantly.
I know years ago when I was building, I did build some houses near creeks where we had to put in a backup leach line, you know, just in case it failed, that you could immediately turn it over. And I didn't know if that was part of this process or not, but thank you.
I don't think you'll be doing anything near a creek anymore. That'll be a whole nother ball game. Any other council questions? And I know, speaking to this a bit, having been appointed by the governor to sit on a regional water quality control board, it is a 5-county region, is our Central Coast Water Board. And one thing that our director used to be very proud of is he said, our water board, Central Coast Water Board, had more lines of code than any other water board in the state. Lines of code. What that means, each board operates independently. So they have created more laws or rules than any other water board in the state. So we happen to be in a district that has a water board that sets a very high standard. Now, we can meet that standard, but it's very important to meet that standard. And someone, you mentioned point source. You know, when the federal government created the Clean Water Act, they put in very powerful tools to fight multinational corporations that had giant point source pipes going into lakes that people were drinking out of. That power has been delegated to the states, which has been delegated to a regional board that operates independently. We can't raise taxes on you. We cannot make a profit. The water board can. They can implement fees that are more than cost recovery. They can keep the money that is raised within their own jurisdiction, and they can hire more staff to do more inspections. So I don't think folks completely realize the difference of dealing with a state water board agency compared to city. We're used to our staff really working, trying to figure out how to make this work at a very low cost. Their primary goal is to make protect water. And they would often look at water should be returned to the same quality that you started with. Now, that's tough when we receive municipal water that is at a drinking water standard. That's kind of what they're talking about, coming out of a septic system. And when I appeared before the water board representing the city, the chairman said, Mayor O'Malley, how can you guarantee that no one will dig a well too close to their septic system? And I said, well, because we're not stupid in Atascadero. But I also went on to say that we have managed our water system for 100 years and with zero nitrates at the wellhead, which means there is no contamination. We've done a good job managing it, so I'm confident that we should go ahead with this and we should demonstrate the geology of how our systems have worked for 100 years without causing any contamination. Because think about it. I was just talking with a group today about cost-benefit analysis. I don't really care that it's going to cost us $50,000. That's a cost. Did you hear me say the proposal a few years ago was 5,400 septic systems times $500 a year? Do you know how much that adds up to be? It's more than $50,000. Do you know how much these systems would cost that they're proposing? These are $40,000, $50,000 systems. I know because I've put one in. These are very expensive. That's each one. So we are protecting our community, I believe, not only protecting our water because we've managed it well in our community, but we're also protecting the pocketbooks of our community by this investment. So this is an area, you know, having experienced this. I was on the water board when they were taking a look at the Monterey Bay Aquarium and thinking they weren't taking good enough care of their water. And they, believe me, really care about their water at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. So it's a tough group to deal with. I think you guys have done a very good job interfacing with them. So I just had to share some of my experience that I think you're right, we need to take this very serious. We need to do a good job at this, because the alternative, I think, would be something our community would be surprised at. With that, seeing no other questions by council, I'm going to open up to the public and welcome any of your input. Seeing no one rushing forward, bring it back to the council. I'm going to go ahead and make a recommendation to adopt staff's recommendation. We can still have some discussion after a second, but I think we need to go forward with this.
I'll second it.
We have a second. Motion by Mayor O'Malley, seconded by Councilwoman Fonzi. I will allow any discussion or comments before we vote if anyone has any last word to say. No words to say. Councilman Kelly.
As most people probably know, I do not like to spend reserve money, but in this case, I think we're being extorted by the state of California again. And I agree with Mayor O'Malley, this is a good investment for the citizens of Atascadero to protect them from any further negative actions from the state of California. So with that, can I place my vote, or how we?
Well, we'll go ahead and ask the city clerk to help us out there. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Fonzi.
Yes.
Councilmember Sturdivant.
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno.
Yes, ma'am.
Mayor O'Malley.
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
And thank you, and good job, staff, on working on this on behalf of our community. That takes us to item C2.
And that would be my item.
That would be, yes. And as you often point out to me, something brief by a city attorney is like 50 pages. But
we have no money left.
Well, Councilman Kelly points out we have no money left, so go ahead.
I promise this will take no more than an hour and a half. Okay.
Well, we're paying for the first half hour. Take all the rest of the time you want.
Okay, it'll take half an hour then. Proposition 64, this is the Control, Regulate, and Tax Adult Use of Marijuana Act, which is a mouthful. The acronym for it is the AUMA. And this is a measure that is on the ballot for November 8th of 2016, and it proposes to legalize and regulate recreational marijuana in California and establish a regulatory system. It's important to have as an overview that there are two different kinds of aspects to this proposition. There's the business side of it, and then there's the personal use and cultivation side of it. So the state licenses that are going to be issued, which won't go into effect until January 1 of 2018, will relate to the business part of the recreational marijuana, and that includes cultivators, manufacturers, distributors, retailers, and testing laboratories. All of those types of businesses will be required to get a state license. If you're just a personal user, you don't need to get a state license to do that. Now, there's some key features to Proposition 64, and I'll go through those now. First of all, a city may prohibit all marijuana businesses if they choose to do so. And let me pause for a minute and say, there is no action that is required of the city at this time. The city may wait until after the election and then consider what ordinances are appropriate to address the this act, and so there is no need to rush out and try to get something done before that. The second key feature is that the state is not going to issue a license to a marijuana business if the proposed business would violate a local ordinance. So, for example, if you are going to prohibit marijuana dispensaries in your city, as you do now, you prohibit medical marijuana dispensaries. If you wanted to prohibit a retail sale of marijuana in the city by ordinance, you can do that, and the fact that there is a state law does not prevent you from doing that. It does not preempt your ability to take that action. The third point, which is one that I've already mentioned, is that the state is not going to be issuing licenses for the businesses, the types of which I described a few minutes ago, until January 1 of 2018. The fourth point is that individuals may possess limited amounts of marijuana and marijuana products and or cultivate up to six plants. Number five, no more than six plants may be cultivated at any time at a private residence. Number six, cities may reasonably regulate private indoor cultivation but may not completely prohibit it. Now, what that means is that there have been situations reported where someone is growing marijuana inside of their residence, and they do so with dangerous methods. They might, and I don't have familiarity with all of the details, but I understand that there's certain types of electricity or gases or whatever to try to accelerate the growth or increase the potency or whatever the specific issue might be, and that can create a risk. There was a situation that occurred in, I believe it was New York, where fire department responded to what was called a marijuana house, and there was an explosion that occurred at that house, and a piece of the roof came down and landed on a firefighter and killed him. So there are risks with indoor cultivation of marijuana that the city may wish to look at, and my concluding remarks are going to relate to kind of a timetable for when this is going to be studied. So we don't need to rush out and do this in the next few weeks, but we do plan on having this done soon after the election to begin the analysis and then in a reasoned fashion come back to you with some recommendations in the spring. The seventh point, get my PowerPoint to catch up with my mouth. The seventh point is that the cities may completely prohibit private outdoor cultivation if you choose to do that. And the last point is that cities may impose local taxes on marijuana retailers and cultivators. So as I said earlier, cities can wait until after the election to adopt these ordinances, and the state's not going to issue any licenses until wouldn't be effective until January 1 of 2018, and you can wait until after the election to adopt your ordinances. So before I get to the recommendation, which is to receive and file the report, there are some next steps that are described in your staff report that I'll spend just a few minutes on here. First of all, we expect that during the period from now moving forward until January, staff will do some research on the marijuana legislation to determine the scope of it. We've got a pretty good idea of what it is already, so a lot of that analysis has already been done. We will secondly gather technical data on marijuana cultivation, including indoor and outdoor grow cycles. That'll we hope to accomplish that in January of 2017. Thirdly, we will do an evaluation of the zoning and the land use implications on cultivation. We predict that that will be done by February. Number four, we're going to hold community meetings to hear concerns from citizens on marijuana cultivation. We expect that to be in the February-March timeframe. And then finally, come back to the council with a proposed ordinance to revise the current ordinances and to address the adult use marijuana issues. And we expect that that would happen in approximately May. So that's kind of our timetable. A lot of cities are looking at different issues relating to this, and there's no cookie cutter ordinance that is going to apply. Each city will have to evaluate its own needs and its position with regard to these various issues and make those decisions. We would seek your input as to what you would like to see in that ordinance. We will give you a menu of choices, the pros and cons of each, and then once you give us that direction, we can draft up the ordinances and bring those back to you at a future meeting. And as you know, with an ordinance, you have the first reading, and then at your next council meeting, typically you would have the second reading, and then that ordinance would go into effect 30 days thereafter. There are exceptions to that. If for some reason something is happening which requires quicker action than that timetable, you can have what's called an urgency ordinance, which can be adopted at the first reading. There is no need for a second reading, and it becomes effective upon adoption. So if something should happen that's untoward, that we see that if we want to take some action quickly, we do have the opportunity to do that. So that, I think, completes my report. I'm available for questions, and I know I didn't use all my 30 minutes.
Well, then we can have some questions then. And I would say I think our council is taking an analytical approach. We want to take a look at this. It's complex with a lot of different community opinions on it. We also want to have a lot of public process that we've built in so that we really are going to make sure everyone has their input. I also will have some confidence always in our city attorney, but your firm, I believe, has some staff that is working on this in parallel statewide, so we have access to a lot of research on this more than a city might normally have. Is that correct?
That's true. My partner, Steve McEwen, is on the state marijuana committee, and he was one of the presenters on a webinar that was held a few days ago on Proposition 64, and he's a valuable resource to us on this. And he's working with many other cities, so he'll be able to provide us with some good information as we move forward.
Very good. Thank you. We have a number of council members with questions. First, Councilwoman Moreno, followed by Councilwoman Fonzi.
Brian, if Prop 64 does pass, does the city, our ordinances that we currently have in place regarding no smoking at, you know, city parks and around facilities, will that include marijuana? Are they termed and everything written appropriately that would include that, or is there any escape clause in there?
Yeah, it's my understanding that smoking of marijuana would be prohibited, recreational marijuana, wherever tobacco smoking is prohibited.
Okay, so we don't need to go through and change the wording in our ordinances?
I don't believe so, but I'll confirm that. But okay. That is my understanding, is that if smoking of tobacco is prohibited, then marijuana would be as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Councilman Fonzi.
Thank you. I know under the medical marijuana, people are allowed to have a cooperative that they choose not to grow it at home, and they give their permission to some other agency to grow marijuana for them. Will that be something that also will apply to this particular law?
Well, that would be a cultivation business, and they would need to get a license from the state to do that.
Okay.
And they won't be effective until January 1 of 2018. So when I was at the League of California Cities, I went to a session on the Proposition 64, and it was explained that it is anticipated there will be many regulations that end up getting adopted, because when you have a statute or a proposition that sets forth general rules, there's always the details that get worked out. So it's my understanding that there's going to be some regulations that will be implemented as well to help address these issues. And there is some learning that has gone on by the fact that some other states have approved recreational marijuana use. I think Colorado is one, and Washington. So we're learning from their experiences.
Right. That's a good thing. You mentioned that at times there have been problems, and we all know that it can't. Indoor growing of marijuana can be a hazard. I'm wondering how we're going to incorporate the fire department into this, and how we will regulate or enforce this cultivation of up to 6 plants indoors.
Well, that is an excellent question, and I don't know that there's a excellent answer. I'll do the best I can. My understanding is that what's being considered would be some type of a system where there would be a permit and an inspection process based on public safety considerations. Because obviously if you live in whether you live in a single family residence or multi-family, it should be safe either way. But especially if you're in a multiple family situation, you're in an apartment building, let's say there's 6 other apartments in the building, and if you're one of them and you're growing marijuana, we certainly want to make sure that it's done in a safe manner. Obviously there would be costs associated with such a system, and there'd have to be a way to figure out how to deal with that. Perhaps the taxes could be a source of revenue, or there could be a fee charged for that. That's part of that's still being sorted out as to how to address that. But I know there is concern as to how to address the safety issue for indoor cultivation, and we'll have to look at that, and that'll be among the options that we'll be able to bring back to you early next year.
Now, we had a speaker tonight, Ms. Eckhart, that mentioned some problems with marijuana next door. Who would enforce those types of issues, let's say growing outdoors when you're only supposed to do it indoors? Would that be the police department?
Well, I'm trying to recall our discussion on that. I believe the chief has some input.
So there's two different, as he's already pointed out, there's two different kind of provisions within this particular ordinance or law that would pass. One would be the kind of purview of the police department. We would enforce some of the regulatory provisions of people using, where they use, and where they have possession of the drug. Some of the other provisions for the cultivation would typically fall under the code enforcement side of our house. And so depending on which specific question we're addressing with regard to her concerns, that would be either the police department or code enforcement. And in some cases, it's a cooperative effort between the two departments.
Thank you. And one last question. Are you recommending, as our city attorney, that we review our medical marijuana at the same time to make sure that they're in sync?
Yeah, absolutely. We'd want to make sure because, you know, there's the cultivation issue, both indoor and outdoor. When you've got medical marijuana, you may want to allow medical marijuana for one reason or another. The sales issue is another one. So we'd have to look at the whole panoply of this. You can't just isolate it. And one of the enforcement issues is going to be, how do you determine whether or not it's being grown for, marijuana is marijuana as far as I know. I don't think there's like medical marijuana and recreational marijuana. It's marijuana. So that would be part of the challenge, is to how do you evaluate whether or not, let's say somebody has a plant outdoors, is that a medical marijuana plant or is that a recreational marijuana plant? So yes, I guess that was the lawyer's answer, but the short answer is yes.
I don't mean to sound like a total novice, but I'm really not very acquainted with marijuana, having never personally been using it or being around it. Are there particular marijuanas that are used for medical that would be different than recreational, or is it all pretty much the same stuff?
I have no idea either, but I'm suspecting that, I'm understanding that there's different potencies, and I mean, what I've read in the newspaper about, you know, that these dispensaries have different types, and I don't know if they give them names, but I don't know the details of all that. It's going to require, I don't think they have like medical marijuana, a brand that's medical marijuana. I think it's just marijuana, and you are allowed to use it if you qualify for medical reasons.
Perhaps I could address the question. Marijuana is marijuana. The difference in the quality of marijuana is the difference in how it is produced. Grown with certain types of processes, marijuana can increase in potency. The level of the THC that's in marijuana can increase dramatically, and so you can see changes in the potency from anywhere of a 5% THC level up to 35% and beyond. Any marijuana is going to be classified just as marijuana. The term medical marijuana is only in use because of the Compassionate Care Act that we have. Marijuana is marijuana.
And one of
Thank
the,
you for that clarification. I appreciate that. One last question, and I'll let you go, since we don't want to take up your time. But I know that marijuana oil has been something that's been in the news, has medicinal uses, and I believe it has recreational uses as well, and that the production of this is actually very hazardous. Is this included in this act, or is that a sidebar issue?
Yeah, I believe it's marijuana or its products is what it says in the proposition. And one thing I forgot to mention is that marijuana is still illegal to possess or use marijuana under federal law. So the current administration has not enforced those laws, but that doesn't mean that it's not still a violation of federal law. I'm not quite sure how much longer that attitude of non-enforcement is going to continue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Councilman Sturdivant.
Just a clarification on the ban of or reasonable ban of or of indoor cultivation, because I was looking through the frequently asked questions, and it's talking about, the question was, can private individuals cultivate non-medical marijuana at home beginning on November 9th, 2016? And it said, because this activity is not subject to state licensing requirements, private individuals may cultivate up to 6 living marijuana plants indoors beginning November 9th, unless the city enacts an ordinance imposing a reasonable regulatory scheme that would preclude them from doing so before complying with the city's regulatory requirements. Cities cannot adopt or enforce bans on private indoor cultivation of 6 living non-medical marijuana plants on or after November 9th, 2016. So that just sounds to me like if we're going to reasonably regulate indoor marijuana, it would have to be done prior to the election.
That is the implication, but that is not the fact. The fact is that you can wait until after the election to adopt a reasonable regulatory scheme that would preclude them from violating your ordinance at that point in time. So if someone, let's say, for example, on November 9th, decides to start cultivating in their home, and then in February or March, you adopt an ordinance that requires them to have a permit, they're required to get a permit.
Very good.
There's no state preemption that is involved with that. You have the right to adopt those ordinances to regulate that use, no matter when they start growing their plant.
Thank you.
Any other council questions? You're breaking your promise. Go ahead, Councilman.
One more. And this is regarding land use, that I know that you can zone the business, if you choose to have this in the city, for cultivation or manufacturing. Would CEQA apply to that?
I don't believe so, but we'll definitely put that on the list of issues to look at.
Thank you.
Any other council questions? Including Councilman Fonzie. No. Okay. We're going to open up to the public. Any member of the public wishing to comment on this item? Again, we're not taking any action, but if you have some questions on some items that you don't think we have addressed, this is not a bad time to get it to staff to make sure that they are prepared to answer those questions when they take a look at this in depth. Again, I want to reassure the public, we're going to really research this. We're going to see the reaction of the state and how the election goes. But in any case, we're going to look at this issue, and we're going to very much have a public process. This won't be something that we do quickly. We're going to do it thoroughly. With that, again, is any member of the public wishing to speak on this item? Welcome.
Hello, my name is Gary Lee, resident of Atascadero. I've been involved in the industry since 1996, and I just want to say that born and raised around here, when I was a kid, before Mr. O'Malley was mayor, and many of you were city councilmen, I can remember that we had Pizzini Winery and York Mountain Winery and maybe one or two others. The wine industry came into here, and it's an industry, very large one, and from what I remember, Atascadero here didn't really want to take part because of DUI problems, because of multiple problems that I can't remember because I was a little younger then. It was a long time ago. But Paso Robles and Templeton both jumped on that bandwagon really good, and now they have a way better class of restaurants up there than we do here in Atascadero. It's hard for us to even keep the Carlton open. They have many nice hotels, a lot of tax revenue, thousands of jobs were created from that industry. And we're talking about an industry that many winemakers are barely breaking even or even operating in the red. Their product is worth about $3,000 to $5,000 a ton. And now a new industry is coming into the area. And whether we embrace it or not here in Atascadero, it is coming to our area. They will just grow 5 miles out of town. It's going to be coming through here. The product is something that the police will have to deal with. There are going to be problems associated with it, just like DUIs are. But what we need to do is get it under our jurisdiction, get it regulated, taxed, permitted, and legal businesses, not black market businesses, which were being talked about earlier, which are very criminal, and we need to do something about. I think that if we look at it from the sense that this could be something coming in and generate many thousands of jobs in our area, tax revenue, it could be a whole different thing that we should jump on the bandwagon before Templeton and Paso Robles. Like I said, I've done this for a living since 96. Right now I'm working with several wineries that are already growing and getting ready to process and going on. They don't want to be public. It's one of those things that, oh, no, the cannabis industry's coming to town. Oh, here's my number. Call me later. You know, it needs to be out in front. It needs to be something that the police can come in and inspect, that city councils can inspect. And I guess I got to go. But I do want to say that my name's Gary Lee. You can talk to me. Anybody, I will meet you guys as a group or individuals and tell you maybe a little bit about the industry and working with it legally. And
thank you.
I'm done.
You're done. Thank you. But
thank
come
you
on back.
Listening.
We'll have more opportunities in future meetings. Yes, if you would like to address, we have 3 minutes again.
All right. Well, thank you for your patience with me. I'm Deborah Eckhart, and I think you heard the first part of my story. Because of my personal experience, I started doing research, and the research unveiled a lot of information that I didn't know before. Now, I'm a child of the 70s, and like many children of the 70s and 60s, I partook of marijuana at that time. It was the thing that so many people did, and I did too. But one thing that I found out through all of the research, talking to people, reading material, etc., I wanted to make sure that I was not basing my opinion or my view, the view that I've stated tonight, merely on subjectivity. I wanted to make sure that I could prove myself wrong if I could do so. And I was right, in my opinion. The anecdotal and scientific evidence is very clear. Today's marijuana is not that of 30 years ago. And even 10 years ago. If we let this go in our community, we are unleashing and endorsing generations of people who fail to thrive, fail to become educated, fail to strive to achieve and honor the best in themselves and to live up to their potential. The values, hopefully, that their parents and grandparents gifted to them to use the time-proven practices and the disciplines needed to compete and make valued-based contributions in our world will fade away faster than they already are today. It will change a larger portion of our society and contribute to a state of ambivalence amongst us, in the individual and therefore in families. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member of the public wishing to speak? Seeing no one come forward, we'll close public comment, bring it back to council. This is a receive and file. Unless there's one last comment by council, we'll move on. Seeing no lights light up, move on to the next category. Again, we will lump them together: council announcements, reports, committee reports, and I'm going to start with my left, work my way to my right, and then we will adjourn.
No comments or reports.
No reports.
No comments or reports.
No report.
No reports.
Any staff input? We are adjourned. Thank you.
a very efficient meeting.